From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey and Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina made history in November with their election victories. They are now the only African-American members of the U.S. Senate, and they are also the only two popularly elected black Americans to serve simultaneously in that body in all of U.S. history. Today, we're devoting this entire hour to a conversation with Senators Booker and Scott. I started our conversation by asking Senator Scott what his legislative agenda is for the new Congress, which, of course, has now just convened.
I'd love to tell you about why my agenda is what it is, to tell you the truth, because for me, growing up in a single-parent household, I lost my way. I was the kid that was not doing well in high school. Mm-hmm. I flunked out of high school as a freshman. I failed world geography. I might be the only senator to ever fail civics. Mm. Failed Spanish and English. My joke is, if you fail Spanish and English, they don't call you bilingual. They call you bi-ignorant, because you can't speak in English. And that's where I found myself. And so when you look at my agenda, the foundation of it is the Choice Act or education, because I learned the wrong way mm-hmm. how to find the right way. And so the wrong way was not paying attention, not being focused. And the right way was learning to focus my attention for my future. And so part of my agenda in the Senate is to help kids like myself, mm-hmm. growing up in single-parent households, struggling in school, unfocused and drifting, to know that there's a better way, and to give their parents more choices so that that child has a better chance. And then from the Choice Act or the education, mm-hmm. I go on to something about the energy economy that we have.
Hold that thought 1 second. Yeah, before you go to the energy economy, when you say choice, what do you specifically mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is a couple things. Number one, I want parents to have more choices. So for me, that means whether it's public school choice, whether it's charters, whether it's alternative schools, whether it's online schools, whether it's private schools, I want parents to be empowered when their schools are underperforming to be empowered to make the right decision for their children. In Charleston County, we have a private-public partnership that's working right now. Mm-hmm. It's gonna raise the outcomes of these kids trapped in underperforming areas. And through that public-private partnership, I believe these kids will have a much brighter future, and they'll be able to take advantage of the real American dream.
I wanna move on, and my time with you is so short in this first segment here, but is there predominant reason to your mind why public schools are failing certain children?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons, mm-hmm. and no question about that. I think part of the reason is that the child that shows up on day one is sometimes underprepared or unprepared for what they're looking at. Mm-hmm. What I hope to do is to take a serious look at how do we improve the outcome of education by focusing on getting the parents and the children more engaged, more involved, more integrated into the system. I think that will improve the outcomes, which will improve our economy as well.
Okay, so the second part of your opportunity agenda is?
Focuses on the need for us to have more energy exploration, because in the end, what I've realized personally is that the more time we spend focusing on our energy opportunities or our energy economy, the more I realize that the STEM part of education, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, math, is a great door, a great gateway to the American dream, especially for children of color. Mm-hmm. So we are so underrepresented in that arena that what we do through the SEA Jobs Act, one of my pieces of legislation, is we focus on connecting with HBCUs and the STEM industry and the energy industry and getting them all working together. Mm-hmm. So we have a real opportunity to investigate our offshore opportunities and at the same time create a pathway to our HBCUs as well as other colleges to make sure that our kids have a better opportunity to move forward.
The third part of your agenda is?
Is the LEAP Act. Mm-hmm. I like the concept of earning while you learn. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, you really think about the ability to work at a job where you can get trained and at the same time, not only are you earning a living, you're also learning skill sets. So if you look at the future economy, one of the things that we know about the future economy is that the middle skills, you need more than a high school diploma, mm-hmm. but not quite the college degree. So the LEAP Act, which focuses on apprenticeship programs, is a wonderful opportunity for us to actually carpe diem, seize upon the opportunities of mm-hmm. the day. And so those three parts of it really lead us in the direction of a better economy for every single American. The final component of it is the Skills Act, which mm-hmm. has become a part of the law that was passed on the Workforce Innovation Act. What we see in the Skills Act is an opportunity for us to see more people going into a field where they use their head and their hands at the same time. And so we want to explore more opportunities for kids and for young adults to find their path in the workforce.
So we're going to talk to Cory Booker, as I said just a second here, Democratic Senator from New Jersey, and then be joined by the two of you for the rest of this program. But as I sit here listening to what you've just laid out, that could very well be a Democratic agenda. I didn't hear anything Republican about that. So what part of this does Cory Booker help you with?
Well, I think if Cory's smart, he helps you with all four.
Yeah.
He's a Rhodes Scholar, so he should be helping with all four. I think where Cory and I have found pay dirt, the common ground, has been on the LEAP Act. I think we'll have a large conversation on a number of topics. But the truth of the matter is he brought the LEAP Act in its founding principles from South Carolina to me. So you got a New Jersey guy who saw a program that's succeeding in South Carolina, came to the South Carolina Senators, says, let's get together on this. Let's make this a national model where folks get tax credits to hire folks, to take the chance that people put people back at work. Mm-hmm. By doing so, he gave me a chance to uncover greatness in my state. And together we have promoted the LEAP Act, and I think we'll see amazing things happening over the next decade.
After a few minutes of conversation with Senator Scott, I then asked New Jersey Democrat Senator Cory Booker about his bipartisan approach to policymaking and his partnership with Senator Scott in particular. Booker last November won election to a full six-year term after winning a special election in 2013 to fill the unexpired term of the late Senator Frank Lautenberg.
I came down watching, I was a mayor watching Washington and being frustrated with how it wasn't working. And so one of the missions we came down and we campaigned on it was that we're not going to come down here to be the Democratic senator from New Jersey, but to be New Jersey's senator to try to get things done. And so one of the strategies my team has used is to look at the red states in America, run by governors, Republican governors, Republican legislators, and what are they doing that's good and interesting and making a difference. And so from red states moving on criminal justice reform to his home state, being the best state in America, really, in many ways, to advance apprenticeships. And as Senator Scott said really eloquently, frankly, we live in a world that has changing skills demands. And you're going to start seeing a lot of people be able to live very good middle class lives, not necessarily graduating from college. High school's not quite enough, but having a set of skills, whether it's machinists or in the medical profession, skills and training that they can only get often on the job, as he said, that you can earn while you learn, and then get a skill set that is marketable in a 21st century economy. And other countries are way outstepping us. They've got it. They got it a lot better a long time ago. Germany, for example, has a very, very high skilled population and uses apprenticeships as one of the main thrusts to their economy. Even Canada, our neighbor to the north, way outsteps us in America in terms of apprenticeships. And when I went around New Jersey and talked to companies, manufacturers, people in the medical profession, people in a wide variety of industries and said, what do you need? I thought I was going to hear access to capital, which I did. I thought I was going to hear government regulations, some of which I heard, the challenges with that. But one of the biggest things I heard is the ability to find skilled folks. And they're not finding them graduating from college. They're often finding them having gotten that training on the job.
So that's one of the ideas that the two of you are going to work on. And I'm honored, as I said earlier, to have the rest of this program to talk to both of you together. But tell me more about what your specific legislative focus is going to be. I've talked to you in the past about your criminal justice work. I know that REDEEM Act didn't quite work out. You can tell me more about that. But what do you hope to get done in this session of Congress?
Right. Well, I'm really excited. I landed with just a year left in the last Congress, was elected to a special to fulfill the remainder of the term from Senator Lautenberg, who tragically passed away in office. And so one of the biggest obvious things for me as a guy who was a mayor struggling to deal with challenges in an urban community is this outrageous reality we have in America, really offensive to American sensibilities. We're singular in the globe, in all of the history of humanity, in the fact that we have 5% of the globe's population, but we incarcerate 25% of the globe's incarcerated people, and the overwhelming majority, over 70%, are there for nonviolent offenses. This is a massive drag on our economy, upwards of $250 billion a year, or arguably more, and taxpayers are paying for a prison population that's exploded in the last 40 years. Federal prison population, 800% in the last 30 years alone. And then if you look at it and see that it is not only punishing taxpayers, it's actually making our economy worse, because once you get out of prison, say you have a nonviolent drug charge for possession of marijuana, for example, something the last three presidents admitted to doing, that now suddenly you have collateral consequences that make you it harder for you to do what we want you to do, which is get a job. People don't want to hire you, can't get training or education, you can't get a Pell Grant to go to college. All of these things we do to make it harder for you to re-enter the workforce. And so this is a system that has hurt America, undermined economic possibilities for people, hurt taxpayers, and then made real racial realities in our country far worse. We know now factually that African Americans and whites have no difference in drug usage, mm-hmm. but an African American will be 3.7 times more likely to be arrested for using marijuana than somebody that's white. And if you go further, you see that this over-incarceration of Americans in general, African Americans in particular, has created a reality where we have a higher black incarceration rate and percentage of population than apartheid South Africa did. In fact, there are more African Americans now today under criminal supervision than all the slaves in 1850. Mm-hmm. You have weird realities like the state of New Jersey, this progressive state where blacks are about 12-13%, somewhere around there, of the state's population, but over 60% of the prison population. And so what I'm going to do legislatively, and what I'm excited about, is again, red states are leading, mm-hmm. places like Mississippi, places like Georgia, who are declining their prison populations, and guess what else is happening? Crime is going down as well, by empowering people to be successful, by making common sense changes that the federal world hasn't done. Now, there's really good legislators, people like Rand Paul, people like Mike Lee, Senator Cornyn, Senator Scott, even Senator Ted Cruz and I talked about this, that all believe that we should be doing things because it's an idea whose time has come. Newt Gingrich, Grover Norquist, national Christian evangelical leaders are saying, wait a minute, this belies our religious values. This belies fiscal conservatism. We can change things legislatively, and that's going to be one of my thrusts.
I want to ask Senator Scott to come back in a second and join us for the rest of this hour. And I think I want to start our conversation with the three of us on whether or not you think America has the will to do that. With all that we've seen dividing this country around the shooting deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, and all that we saw come out of that, how divided the country was around those deaths of these unarmed black men, I want to know whether or not you think the country really has the stomach now, the will, to advance on an issue of criminal justice like the one you just laid out. Give me your best argument for why you think the country is interested in advancing on criminal justice, given the fallout that we saw across America with these protests in the streets about the killings of these unarmed black men.
Well, because first and foremost, it's already being done. Mm-hmm. And that's the exciting thing. You've got states like Georgia that have done reforms that over the last 5 years have reduced their prison population significantly. Their black prison population, 20%. Mm-hmm. And I think states are starting to realize, wait, we can save taxpayer money, we can lower the crime rate, and we can empower people to enter into the economy. The profound logic of it, I think, is going to create the movement. And when I have conversations, fruitful conversations, with conservative peers of mine, conservative activists, right before I left for the holidays, Grover Norquist and I sat and had a great conversation. Then we met again on the Colbert Show, the final episode, and had another conversation about criminal justice reform. So you're going to see this being led not only by the people you might suspect, but really led by Republican leaders and leaders on the right.
Senator Scott, I don't know, I'm sure you were asked about this, but in my research, I didn't see this. So this may be the first time that many people in the audience have seen a Republican senator from South Carolina who happens to be an African American share his views on how he processed the killing of these unarmed black men. How did you process that? What did you make of that?
Well, I think it's been a, tears were perhaps my first response. Mm-hmm. Just the devastation of the loss of life. Hard to digest, from Ferguson to Garner in New York. The video in New York, tragic. I thought that was a clear opportunity for an indictment if I ever saw one. Mm-hmm. But for me, I also thought about where I've come from. Mm-hmm. Once again, growing up in the place where I've grown up and knowing that some of my friends that I grew up with were killed, black on black crime. And so for me, it's looking at the issue holistically and looking for real solutions, not just an outcome, but the process to getting to the outcome. And so for me, I focus back on my agenda of education, such a powerful tool. When you look at the incarcerated population, you'll find that being functionally illiterate, single-parent households and poverty drives who's in prison. I want to change that. I listened very carefully to the conversation y'all had, and it was a very interesting and necessary conversation. I look forward to engaging with Corey. I mean, one of the things I've seen is from the left, folks like Corey, to the right, Ted Cruz or Rand Paul, to the folks, I think the ACLU, to the Koch brothers, all focusing in on this issue of our incarceration rates and looking for ways to reduce it. So criminal justice, I think, will be on the table, not just for the next couple of years, but for the next decade. Mm-hmm. This should be good news for those who really want to see a transformation happen in America.
So explain to those persons who are still feeling more than trepidation about giving the Republican Party a try when they have stories in their papers about Representative Scalise, who spoke to a white supremacist group some years ago. To his credit, he apologized for that. He said he wasn't aware of it. I'm not sure I buy that. That's neither here nor there. But the Republican leadership, he is the number three leader in the House, so this is not your body, this is the House, but you once served in the House.
I did.
But all the Republican leadership rallied around this gentleman, Mr. Scalise. Nobody asked him to step down. How do you explain to African Americans in particular, anybody, any other person of good conscience and goodwill, how the party, who you say, you know, has an opportunity to do some good work on criminal justice, wraps themselves around a guy who would speak to a group like that?
Well, I would probably start the conversation with people who know him best, like members of the Congressional Black Caucus, like specifically Cedric Richmond, who said very clearly, knowing Scalise for more than 12 years, said that he doesn't have, Cedric talking about Scalise, he doesn't have a racist bone in his body. For me, that was good enough. The fact of the matter is, if we're going to blaze a path going forward for America, we're going to do so by bringing folks together. I remember back in the days when the elected members of the Senate were former members of the Klan who were Democrats. So let us not put in place the fact that somehow the Republican Party or the Democratic Party has the strongest position on the issue of race. What we know for sure is that the issues of flaws are issues of people. It's a human condition, not a Republican condition or a Democrat condition. It's a human condition. So I was very surprised and interested to see the response that Steve Scalise has received from folks like Cedric and others around the nation who know him the best.
Yeah. I always want to say Corey because I've known
you
Senator
should
Booker.
Say Corey.
I've known
he
him for so long, though.
Senator Booker. I can't wait till I
I have known Senator Booker for so long. We've been friends for so many years. But I'll ask you first, Senator Booker, what is it like being one of only two? This is a historic and exclusive conversation. The two of you have never sat for a conversation together. One Republican, one Democrat, both African American. What's it like being in this august body of 100 and being the only two who look like you do?
Well, look, you know, the first thing I did before I got sworn in about a year ago, my mom was with me and she took me to see John Lewis. And we sat in his office in the moments before I took that oath. And his office is like a museum to the civil rights movement. And it was almost like a reminder that my mom wanted me to have before I became the fourth ever, we're four and five here, ever popularly elected African Americans. My mom wanted to let me know sort of what it took, all the conspiracy of love amongst Americans of all backgrounds to make it this country such that I could have enjoy the kind of privilege that I have to serve. And I love what my mom said to me. She said, never forget that the title doesn't make the man has to make the title. And so I'm conscious of the historical context in which I now stand on that floor and feel a calling every day to prove worthy of that. And it is, you know, I still remember a staffer in the Senate who broke down crying when they saw me when I first came in because they said it was just so rare for them to see someone that others would call a senator in a position as an African American in this position. So, you know, you get those reminders. But I think that something that Senator Scott was alluding to, at the end of the day, what matters is what you get done. And that's really the sense of urgency I feel, and I understand a bit about how other major pieces of legislation, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, and other things that I care about passionately, from funding for autism research to science and technology. You have to find ways to create relationships to do the bigger things. And so, you know, what sort of pleased me in Senator Scott and a number of other my Republican colleagues is how willing they were to break down away from a partisan analysis and really focus on, hey, what can we agree upon enough to advance an issue?
The timing of this conversation is propitious and sad. I had the honor of interviewing Ed Brook two or three times in his life on my television and radio programs. And it occurs to me now that you sit here as a black Republican, Edward Brook, black Republican out of Massachusetts. Have you read much about him? Did you ever meet him?
What an aspiring life story. Here's a man who helped really blaze the path going forward. It's so important for us to remember the giants that came before us. And Senator Brook was just a good man who served well and accomplished much.
Do you feel any particular pressure to deliver, whatever that means, given that you are one of only two African Americans in the Senate? I want to ask Corey the same question, but you first.
I think it's important for us to deliver for the country. I think it's important for us to bring this country together. Here's an opportunity for us to show, to lead by example. I think you see in both of us the spirit to do so. We are very interested in finding common ground to cooperate. Neither one of us will abandon our principles, but we do find very consistently common ground on some issues that are important to every single American, and specifically people of color. And so whether it's my opportunity agenda, whether it's focusing on education, the skills, the mill skills that we both have discussed on your show, whether or not it's looking at the LEAP Act and the apprenticeship programs, there's always common ground, but we do need to deliver. Having a conversation is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Having the results and the fruit of that conversation manifest in such a way that it moves America forward, and specifically says to those folks who seem to be trapped outside of the economic opportunity of America, yes, the door is open. Yes, the rungs on the ladder have been replaced. This is a part of the conversation that I will continue to lead.
Senator Booker, do you feel any particular pressure, especially given that you are the former mayor of Newark and black folk around the country have been looking to you for years for this kind of leadership?
Well, you know, I'm one of the Wall Street Journal, I think, said I'm the 21st, I think, mayor that ever has gone straight in the country's history, gone straight to being a United States Senator. I have a unique set of experiences seeing urban America and a lot of the things that weren't being focused on or talked about enough in the United States Senate. So, you know, whether it's why is it when my kids walk into a bodega in a community with overwhelming levels of obesity that they can walk in and find a Twinkie product cheaper than an apple, while we're using our federal subsidies to subsidize that sugar, that corn that's driving down the price of those unhealthy foods. And so my experiences as a mayor have helped inform the urgencies that I feel here in the United States Senate and the desire just to get to work. And that's why when I find folks across the aisle who are so firm in who they are and willing to reach out and share with you that sense of urgency to let's see what we can figure out together and move things forward so life actually gets better for people in South Carolina or New Jersey, that gives me hope. Speaking so much about criminal justice reform, you know, when I can have conversations with Senator Cornyn, have conversations with Senator Scott, with Rand Paul, with Mike Lee, I can go through, you know, at least 10 plus senators on the Republican side who have talked to me about this issue or who have already, in the case of Cornyn, Lee, Paul have already put bills in that would advance the ball down the field. I'm hopeful that in this, even with a Republican majority, a lot of important legislation can move forward. And he and I would agree that on the urgency for tax reform to stop these perverse realities where you have corporations inverting or keeping jobs overseas because they can't repatriate their dollars. He and I would agree that there's still work we can do on education in this country. He and I would agree that we can do things with around apprenticeship programs. So the key for me in this minority role is to search for that common ground, not to spend all my time bickering in a partisan way or just playing defense, but where can we come together and score some points for America?
To the victor goes the spoils, Senator Scott, but there are a lot of Americans, and particularly African Americans, no secret here, who are concerned about what the future holds for them when Republicans now control both houses in Washington. Anything you want to say or can say to allay their fears about the agenda that is to come?
Well, certainly. I think the opportunity agenda should give folks real reason to be hopeful about where the agenda of the Republican Party is going. And one of the things that we want to do is not focus on partisan politics. We want to focus on Americans. The most corrosive force in politics is the partisan debate that focuses and isolates the conversation within rooms of the nation, as opposed to in the living room of our country, where everyone has an opportunity to engage in the conversation and engage in the debate. I'm absolutely conservative, and I think that's good news from my perspective. And what happens from the conservative perspective in the majority is we'll focus on issues like education and opportunity. We'll focus on how do we get this energy economy to hum. The Keystone Pipeline creates 40,000 jobs. This is a positive step in the right direction from my perspective. We both agree on the necessity of tax reform. The president says he wants a lower corporate tax rate. Now the devil's in the details. We all have to get all hands on deck and have a serious conversation. I'm now on the Finance Committee. We'll have a serious conversation about how to make that tax reform happen. And part of the prerequisite for tax reform is changing the way we score it to allow some part of dynamic scoring to be part of the conversation. When that happens, we could see realistically the corporate tax rate, the highest corporate tax in all of the world, coming down to something that's competitive. If that happens, we could see another, in my opinion, another million jobs created by simply lowering the corporate tax rate into the mid-20s. If we allow for repatriation, I think we would both say that there is a need to bring home overseas profits back to our country without making it punitive. That one step brings home perhaps up to $2 trillion, which means that we're creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs with those resources. I think what America will find with this new majority is that we're not going to focus on a Republican agenda. We're going to focus on an American agenda. And if we do that, and we do that right, we can have a serious conversation.
I suspect that people,
and not just African Americans, that who heard what you just said about what the Republican agenda is going to be, but there are people who really feel, Senator Booker, that the Republican agenda is basically anti-Obama, that they don't want this president to succeed. Mitch McConnell, your leader, years ago before you got to the Senate, said his number one job was to defeat Barack Obama. That quote's been talked about time and time again. And I don't know how much time any of the three of us these days spend in barbershops, given the way we look. But if you spend time in barbershops, there are brothers and sisters in beauty salons who believe that the Republican Party wants to defeat him in large measure because he is a black man. You are two black men in the United States Senate. Give me your sense of whether or not you think there are forces in this country, political forces in this town, in the House, in the Senate, who want to defeat him in part because he's the first black president.
Well, clearly there are, when George Bush was a president or when Barack Obama was president, there are people who are coming from partisan camps trying to take somebody down. Mm-hmm. And I have not seen things I've seen since in the Obama presidency ever before. Like, for a president, I don't care who you are, Democrat, Republican, when you stand up and give a State of the Union address, you are speaking for the country. The globe is watching you. They're watching you in China. Your soft power is affected by what happened. So when you have a Republican congressman heckle the presidency, forget who the president mm-hmm. is, and show that level of disrespect, and then turn around and raise money on that, and a lot of money, frankly, that's unacceptable. And I see how moments like that symbolize to many people that they're just not even going to give this guy a shot. But I want to give credence to something he said, if I can pivot just mm-hmm. a little bit to give, because I think that when he talked about the corrosive toxin of that type of partisanship, as soon as I open my mouth, there's a lot of Americans that just say, oh, he's a Democrat, I'm not even going to listen to what he says, that won't take the time to listen to who he is, what his background, where his values, just because he's a Republican, or he'll touch third rails that will make them shut down. He mentioned the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he and I disagree on that. Mm-hmm. And that some people use that as a reason not to listen to him on everything else he has to say. And so what I found in my history, we had a great conversation, wasn't on TV, but it was a great conversation about Jack Kemp mm-hmm. together. And it was at the Jack Kemp Foundation. Yep. And I told people when I was in college, I heard Jack Kemp was coming to a inner city neighborhood to give a talk. I'm a football player at Stanford. And I'm like, no, he won't. Mm-hmm. That Republican is not coming into mm-hmm. inner city for a photo op. I was going there to tell him off. And I remember getting in Jack Kemp's face, and he is a persuasive speaker. And he shut me down just by starting to walk me through all the ways that our government policy was undermining inner city. And ultimately, he was responsible for legislation that I used as a mayor, ideas of empowerment zones, and a lot of the thought that went in that to create one of the largest economic booms in Newark, New Jersey.
But those, but those kinds of person, those kinds of Jack Kemp.
I think it's important because I don't want to leave the show not having addressed the issue. Do Republicans just not like President Obama
Please.
Because he's black? I think we philosophically disagree with many of the positions he's taken. We philosophically disagree with the executive actions that he's taken. So when you find the real heartbeat of why we are in disagreement with the president, it's not because he's black, it's because he's liberal, and because we don't like the policies of the president. And that is very important, because one of the challenges that we face, besides the in D.C., the partisan reality is a challenge. In America, the racial issue is so easy for us to ignite a fire that should be snuffed, it should be put out. And I think it's very important for us to realize that this country is one nation under God. And if we act like it on both sides of the aisle, America will move forward. If we don't act like it on either side of the aisle, America stumbles.
The problem, Cory, Senator Booker,
keep calling me. We've been friends for a long time.
I take your analysis and the story you offer about Jack Kemp. And I get that. I spent time with Jack Kemp, interviewed him, hung out with him a number of times while he was living. But those kinds of Republicans don't exist in Washington anymore. The same was true of Everett Brooke. Everett Brooke was a different kind of Republican. So give me your sense of how the work gets done. I'm going to give you a chance to answer the same question. I want to hear your take too, Senator Scott.
Right, but I'm in Washington. But there's so many, this is now getting a good conversation, because I wanted to continue to talk about race. Should we be talking about the realities of racism in America? Right. It's an important conversation that we should constructively have a discussion about. But right now, let me just say this. When I went up to Orrin Hatch, because I've been trying to meet with every one of my Republican colleagues, and talked to him about the eulogy he gave of Ted Kennedy.
Beautiful.
And how those two men had a sincere love for each other.
Right.
And despite they are right and left, far firm, and found places that they could work together on. I understand, I bemoan the fact that the Republican Party didn't return a Dick Lugar, that Olympia Snowe sort of just grew up and got frustrated with the partisanship. I mourn the fact that we don't have Republicans diversity in that sense. They still do exist. When I see a Corker come out with a Murphy and call for a gas tax, surprised me to deal with infrastructure. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that my job here is not to cast aspersions upon Republicans. There are days I'm frustrated as all get out, and I'm imagining now that I'm in a minority, there's going to be a lot of days that I get frustrated. But my obligation is to seek out my Republican colleagues and say, look, we can sit here and enumerate all the areas we disagree, but can we find two or three things that we can work on together?
But that's my point. My point here is, and I'm not demonizing or bastardizing Republicans either. I invited the senator on the show, and I'm glad he came. My point is, since you were talking about partisanship, that is it not the case that Washington is so partisan now and so polarized at the margins because there aren't the kinds of moderates that there used to be in this town to establish the kind of friendships and relationships that you were talking about?
We're doing it right now.
Yeah.
Well, we've been doing this for 13 months. You've been in the Senate. I've been in the Senate for a little over two years. The fact of the matter is we've been able to establish enough of a relationship where the trust factor has been answered. I trust him. I don't agree with him all the time, but I trust him. Hopefully he trusts me.
You real haircuts.
At least I can go to the barber. I still go to the barber. I'm still trying to help. I'm trying to help small business owners out.
In the hood. Okay.
And so I go to the barber. I was there.
I invited him to join the ball caucus, but he wouldn't.
So I wanted to coach here. You said you already had a coach here. I forgot who it was. But there is an opportunity for us to move this nation forward. And frankly, I think as a conservative Republican, not a moderate Republican, a conservative Republican, we have found areas of agreement. That is empowering for this nation. Not to see moderates who are just barely on the other side of the aisle from one another come together. I think it's even more dynamic when you see folks who are philosophically in stronger opposite positions on some issues finding that common ground.
Does the fact, Senator Scott, that the two of you are the only African Americans in the Senate create some special sort of bond or trust, to use your word?
I think it does. Help that when I walked in to watch him being sworn in, that I said, you know what, I want to know this guy. I want to know his story. His story is exactly the opposite of mine. I mean, you're a smart guy from Stanford.
I a football player from Stanford.
And a real scholar at the same time, right?
Yes.
I'm a guy who flunked out of high school. So two parents, loving parents, IBM, single parent household, growing up, having to move with my grandparents. our stories
are very different. You sound like the Democrat and you sound like the Republican.
The thing is, we find that common ground
in spite
of our differences. Here's what it takes to make progress in America and specifically in Washington. First is rapport. If you don't have the time to establish rapport, you don't have time. Second is credibility. Be credible on the issues that you want to advocate on behalf. Mm-hmm. Third, let's uncover the problems so that we can present solutions and then overcome the objections. If we just follow that very basic formula, we'd find more progress for the average American all over this country, and we'd have more resources around this country helping grow the economy, helping to devastate poverty that has been devastating.
You were joking a moment ago about, we were all joking about, the bald caucus that Corey was asking you to join.
Yes.
With all jokes aside, you turned down an opportunity, an invitation to join the Congressional Black Caucus.
Yes.
Since you raised caucuses, just so I understand it, so that the audience understands it,
certainly.
What was your reason for not wanting to join the Congressional Black Caucus?
I think if we're going to move this country forward together, mm-hmm. we're better together. And so I simply have not been a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Frankly, I had a conversation about a month ago with the chairwoman of the Black Caucus about my legislative agenda on education and skills. And we have found an area where her staff and my staff are looking for ways to bring our teams together, because once again, if we can get folks on different sides of the aisle from different philosophical dispositions to find some common ground to move this country forward, we all win. And so while I'm not a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, the fact is that many of the members of the Black Caucus and I have found some common ground. We obviously disagree on a number of topics.
I've heard the word common ground more times than I can count in this conversation, heard that phrase countless times. And it seems to me that what's lacking in this town is exactly that, compromise. And there are a lot of reasons that senators and House members don't want to compromise. One, because you don't want to look like a loser. You don't want the other guy to win. So how do you ever get to a place of bipartisanship if nobody wants to compromise for being afraid of being cast as having given in to the other side?
Well, look, I'm hoping the pendulum's going to start to swing back. Mm-hmm. When Congress has a lower approval rating than colonoscopies and cockroaches, we all are suffering.
And that's not a joke.
That's not a joke. It's not a joke. It's 100% fact. Yeah. I think America is fed up with this partisanship. And frankly, we in America, many of us reflect the partisanship. I'm sure you did. When the first time we sat down together, my commentary I got from social media and other things, I know you got some remarks as well, about how could you even dare to sit down together? So this is not just a Washington-centric problem. It is a national issue that some of us focus so much on the lines that divide us that they don't realize that the ties that bind us are so much stronger. So I just know that he and I, of this next generation of United States senators, and some great mentors that we have in the caucus, like Lamar Alexander and some others who have been so good to me on the Republican side, and my Democratic colleagues, I just hope that there's more and more of a chance for us to start working together. And I'm down here. I'm not committing to this for life. I'm down here to see if we can actually do that. And I'm willing to sublimate ego, so to speak, to try to find that common ground. And look, there are things that are going to divide us. And if we spend here time, we could have done tonight is debate Keystone Pipeline, mm-hmm. you know, issues of abortion. You know, we could have gone back, and he would not compromise. I would not compromise. But my experience with Governor Christie, frankly, who was a guy I could write my dissertations about my disagreements with him. Mm-hmm. But he and I were joking right before Christmas about the day I came to talk to him about a big economic development package for Newark, and it happened to be the day that New Jersey's legislature approve marriage equality, an issue I'm passionate about. I wouldn't marry anybody, conduct any marriages as a mayor, because I said I'm not going to do it till everybody can get married. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy with the legislature, but I knew the governor was going to veto it. I come out from our meeting and people put microphones in front of me and say, did you give it to the governor about marriage? I said, I didn't talk to him about it at all, because I knew I wasn't going to change his mind. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to change mine. I was there for the 45 minutes I had with the governor about something that's going to create thousands of jobs in Newark, New Jersey, and spent every minute we had delivering for those jobs. And so when I sit with him, I don't want to debate with mm-hmm. him. If I think I can convince him on something, I'm going to try.
Yeah.
But on issues that we know we're not going to move, I'd rather spend my time with him fighting to find that common ground and pushing forward a piece of legislation like the LEAP Act.
Senator Scott, how do you compromise without surrendering your principles?
I think you look for common ground. I think there is a difference between compromise and common ground. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt that common ground is available for those who are looking for it. Mm-hmm. On the issue of education, I think I'm going to find common ground. Chris Murphy from Connecticut, I started talking to him about school choice. He said, yeah, I'm not necessarily for private school choice, mm-hmm. but charter schools and other nuances within the public education footprint, I'm very interested in that conversation. Mike Bennett from Colorado and others have been open to that conversation. So what I keep looking for is the win. I mean, ultimately, what I want people to walk away understanding about this conservative and about what I believe is a conservative movement is that it's open for anyone and for everyone who wants to move America forward. That conversation needs to be had. I'm going to make sure that we're having it on my side. Corey's committed to making sure that he has it on his side. Therefore, we're committed to having a conversation together.
Cory Booker, Senator Booker, do you ever get the sense that ever think about whether it is the case that they like you because you are a fellow U.S. senator but don't really care for your people, that they get you but don't care to get the people that you come from?
So look, when he goes home to South Carolina, I go home to New Jersey, right. And I live in Newark, New Jersey, mm-hmm. Live in the central ward of Newark. And when I talk to friends of mine on my block or in my neighborhood, they probably can't, like I couldn't at one point, name more than three or four United States senators. Mm-hmm. But when you ask them about do they think the criminal justice system is fair, they think it's abjectly unfair. And they saw the incredible over-incarceration of African Americans. And so what I think that they're most concerned with is, can I find people, they don't care what color, what party, what have you, to partner with in correcting an American wrong that we are the leader in the globe. We are the incarceration nation, not China, mm-hmm. not Russia. We put people in prison like nobody, nonviolent folks in prison like nobody, that's destroying lives in my neighborhood. And so they don't care about all the stuff that we often talk about in Washington. What they care is, can we come together and actually get something done? If he and I are successful in expanding apprenticeships in the United States of America that give opportunity to poor white people, to poor black people, folks that may not be going on to get their PhDs from Princeton, and open up our economy, an opportunity economy, then they're happy. And so that's what we need to focus on a lot more. And my extended experience, only 13 months old, is exciting to me is that despite all the noise in Washington about gridlock and the like, and in 13 months, I've been able to find partners, Democrats and some Republicans, to try to find a pathway to make a real difference for the folks I'll return to in New Jersey.
Let me offer this as the exit question. I'll start with you first, Senator Scott. The Senate is changing. This is an august body. There are only 100 at a time. But it's changing. The average age of the senator has gone down. There are now at least two African Americans in the Senate. There are women in the Senate. So the Senate is starting to change. And I don't just mean from Democratic hands to Republican control. What do you hope, believe, want history to say years down the road about what happened in the Senate and what you were able to do to help change this body?
Well, for me, I think my life's mission has been the same for the last 30 years, and I take that mission into the Senate, which is to positively impact the lives of a billion people with the message of hope and opportunity. Hope has a lot to do with faith. So if I were to answer that question honestly, it's Matthew 25:21, well done, my good and faithful servant. How does that happen? For me, you look at the least of those in our country and in our communities, and perhaps the most powerful political body in the world has come together to serve those folks who many would say it would never happen. But because of hopefully our presence and the presence of a living God and present in us, we will have an opportunity to impact this world, this nation, in this body for the rest of eternity.
Senator Booker. So very simply, one of the reasons I have affection, and I'm not sure if I ever said this to you, but one of the reasons I have affection for Tim, not simply the color of his skin, but because his life is like my dad's. Born to a single mom, under tough circumstances, thanks to some very strong mentors.
Your father passed away just before you?
6 days before I was elected.
Yeah.
And so my dad, the toughest conversation I ever had to him is he bemoaned out loud to me that he thinks a guy born poor, black, to a single mother, in a segregated environment in 1936 would have a better chance of making it than a kid born under the same circumstances today. Mm. And it was like a jab at my generation. And so, we've got to change this because my father's words, you can look at them actually with data and see that some of the things he's saying is right. Black or white, social mobility in this country has declined relative to other countries. It is better now, if you just have the goal of making it to the middle class, better to be born in Canada or Germany, it's easier to move up. And wealth disparities are being exaggerated right now in our country, where they're similar between black and white now in our country, not to mention just in general, the disparities of wealth are bad, but between black and white, see, it's as one author was saying, reading recently, it's as bad as apartheid South Africa as well. Mm-hmm. And so we have to make the American dream real for everyone. As Langston Hughes said, there's a dream in this land with its back against the wall. To save the dream for one, we must save the dream for all. And so I'm hoping that our generation of senators can preserve, embolden this American dream and make it more penetrating so everybody experiences the best this country has to offer and aren't cut out because of the circumstances of their birth, because they were born poor, because they had challenges. And we have a lot more work to do to get back to an opportunity economy, to get back to a growth economy, to get back to pathways to training so people can fully participate in this economy, to make sure that the fruits of this economy are enjoyed by all of its people.
Senator Scott, thank you for your time, man.
Absolutely, it's good to be with you.
Senator Booker, thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to have you both here.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.